Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the court, my name is James Dare, and as I said, it's my honor to address the court this morning on behalf of Appellant John Askew. I'll be covering the issue of standing to sue. As I'm sure the court is aware, the issue of standing to sue must be addressed before we reach the substantive issues in the case, because if the plaintiff lacks standing, then the court lacks jurisdiction to hear the substantive issues. Lack of standing cannot be waived and can be brought up at any time. And in a case such as this, where the plaintiff is alleging standing based on an assignment of an account, proof of the assignment is necessary to establish standing. It stands to reason, then, that when there's a chain of assignments, as we have in this case, each link in the chain must be established in order to establish the next link in the chain. In this case, we have John Askew's credit card account, which was originated with Providian Bank, and CACH alleges that Providian was purchased by Washington Mutual, and that Washington Mutual, in turn, assigned John Askew's account to a debt buying company called Worldwide, and that Worldwide, in turn, assigned the account to CACH. What I'd like to focus on this morning is that link in the chain between Washington Mutual and Worldwide. At trial, CACH presented one document as evidence of this link in the chain. That was Exhibit 7. It was a bill of sale from Washington Mutual to Worldwide. Now, we go into great length in our brief about why that document is inadmissible for lack of foundation. But assuming, even for the sake of argument, that it were admissible, it still doesn't aid CACH's case. This document, Exhibit 7, is one sentence long. It never mentions Mr. Askew's name, account number, or any other reference to him. Instead, it references an entirely different document called an account schedule, which is supposedly attached as Appendix A to a third document called a purchase and sale agreement. CACH didn't offer either of these two other documents as evidence at trial. So they only offered one of the three necessary documents that effectuated this alleged transfer.
So are Exhibits 8 and 9 in the record before us?
I'm sorry, Your
Honor? Are they in the record on appeal before us?
Those two documents?
Uh-huh.
No, Your Honor.
Okay.
They only offered the one of the three at trial.
Because the briefs talk about them extensively.
Yes, Your Honor. The brief references, you may be talking about Exhibit 9.
Yes.
Yes. Exhibit 9, Your Honor, is a redacted page of a different document called an account sale agreement. That document pertains to the next link in the chain of assignment between Worldwide and CACH. It does not pertain at all to this link that we're talking about now between Washington Mutual and Worldwide.
And why does opposing counsel say that's not necessary?
That it's not necessary that they establish
that
the first link in the chain?
That link is not fatal to their claim. Why do they say that? Can you address their arguments on that?
Well, Your Honor, they argue that they only need to prove the last link in the chain of assignment from Worldwide to Washington, from Worldwide to CACH.
Are there any cases holding that anywhere?
Not that I found anywhere in the country, Your Honor. There are other places in the country that have addressed this issue, and they have all, as far as I've found, they have all said that we need to prove each link in the chain. And logically, that just makes sense, because how can we say that Worldwide validly assigned this account to CACH unless we can prove that Worldwide owned it to begin with?
The opposing counsel raises the specter that in this day where lots of banks are failing, you may have multiple links in the chain going back where these banks and their records simply don't exist anymore. So in effect, if you had to go back and reprove the chain of title in the early parts of the links, people are gone, they're at different companies, you'd never be able to find them, and all sorts of paper would be bad that people accept in the ordinary course and rely on in their business affairs, and that really would stop commerce. Can you address that, Your Honor?
I don't believe it would stop commerce at all, and as I explain in my reply brief on that issue, Missouri courts have been ruling this way for years on any number of cases with CACH and any number of other debt collection companies, and it hasn't stopped commerce.
So I can understand what you're saying we have to do, we have three different banks. Say we had four or five different banks. Are you saying you'd have to present a person from each bank to talk about, as a practical matter, how would you go about proving it without having to find individuals from each bank in the chain in each of the millions of cases?
Your Honor, you would have to provide a business records affidavit for each link in the chain if they were from different companies like we're talking about. With regard to your comment earlier, Your Honor, concerning, you know, what if the bank has gone out of business and there's no one to testify to that. CACH and other companies like this assume the high risk of uncollectability when they buy these accounts. They buy these things with absolutely no warranties attached. You can see in the bill of sale on these, and they assume that risk. In any other case, when a witness is suddenly unavailable to testify, if a witness dies before testifying, for example, that doesn't suddenly make hearsay testimony admissible to cover it. Instead, the case is simply lost because the rules of evidence.
In fact, 490 is really an exception to provide for hearsay. If you have the custodian of records, you don't really have to have the person who actually filled out the document. You just have to have the real custodian of records who knows that the records were kept, who knows they were kept contemporaneously, and knows the procedure. That's a procedure. If you're going to collect, you got to make sure you know how to you prepare your. If you're going to transfer paper, which has been done for years and years and years, you got to make sure you got this covered if you're going to collect.
Absolutely, Your Honor.
You got to follow the law, not follow what you want to do instead.
Can you distinguish the CACH case versus Lawrence from the Southern District that addressed standing and the Southern District found standing?
Yes, Your Honor. The Lawrence case was withdrawn by mutual consent of the parties and by the appellate court. It was in conflict with all of the same cases that we're discussing here today. And in fact, that case was being moved towards bringing to the Supreme Court when it was resolved by mutual consent of the parties to avoid being here today. So had that case not been resolved, we probably would have been here on that case instead. It was in conflict with 44 years of case law in Missouri and in conflict with dozens of other cases that hold the proper way to interpret our Missouri law.
So did Bank of America, you may not know, but Bank of America acquired a Nations Bank and Boatman's Bank, and there were a whole bunch of bank acquisitions in Missouri. Was this ever a problem in Missouri when they were collecting on other successor loans?
Not to my knowledge, Your Honor. I can tell you from my personal experience, I've been doing this area of law for 5 years, and this is how it's always been done all through Missouri, and it's never been a problem. I don't see the need to create an exception to the hearsay rule for this industry. The debt collection industry should be held to the same standard as every other industry. They have to follow the rule, and what they're asking here is for the court to carve out an exception for their hearsay-driven business model.
If we do it here, then it would be the same thing for foreclosures, for real estate, for every kind of document that's been in the modern day transferred throughout the country and the world.
The ultimate purpose of hearsay rules to begin with is that, in my opinion, is that a first-party narrative is always more reliable than a third-party narrative. That's what the basis of hearsay is about, is you got to get it from the horse's mouth.
So what kind of paper could you have that would not require you to go back and have four or five different witnesses if you had four or five different transfers?
Well, Your Honor, you would need, let's say you have four or five different assignments of this account.
Yes.
And each assignment is effectuated by three documents. There's a bill of sale, there's a sale agreement, and then there's a list of accounts that are actually transferred.
Okay.
You need all three of those in
evidence. So if you had those three, you're not saying you'd have to have an actual witness from each of those transfers. That's what I'm trying to clarify.
Oh, no, Your Honor. You would need a business records affidavit filled out from those companies saying, yeah, these are our documents, and here they are. And then they come
and,
in just like any
other. And we're missing that in the first transfer. You're saying.
You need a custodian of business records of someone. Someone's got to personally be there.
Of course. Well, no, you would need, if you have a business records affidavit from the custodian of records, then obviously you don't need an actual witness to testify. The business records affidavit would substitute.
As I understand your argument here, you're just saying you can't attach something that says, see attached exhibits A, B, and C, and then not be there, and that satisfy the requirements.
Well,
you can't assume what was attached to the to maybe an otherwise admissible document.
In a way, yes, Your Honor. These documents were not put into evidence. That's part of our argument. You're right, that they were not. There was no foundation laid for these documents. They were just alluded to, and they weren't put into evidence. But the larger part of our argument is that their witness, Ms. Eakins, who's an employee of Square 2 Financial, which owns CACH, is not qualified to lay a foundation for these documents. But we're actually getting into Mr. Devereaux's part of this. I was really just meaning to cover standing, so I apologize.
By the way, you have to manage your own time. Your time.
I understand.
I think your co-counsel is anxious to come speak to us.
Good morning. Thank you. With respect to the business records issue in this case, I think it can be distilled into one sentence, and that is that a records custodian cannot lay a foundation for another business's records. And that's what happened in this case. The custodian of records for CACH, Ms. Eakins, the court permitted her to testify and lay a business records foundation.
But could she do this? I did a lot of these cases. There's always someone personally there who testifies the custodian of business records as their procedures or it was made contemporaneously. An affidavit, they're available. Why is it an affidavit? Or unless the law, case law says it is.
To your point, Your Honor, they generally, they always, that I've found, authenticate their own business records. Not CACH doesn't authenticate Providian Bank's records on a document that's 10 years old.
But they have a live person there, don't they?
A live person or a records affidavit, sure, yeah, absolutely. That's the whole point. What we claim is that Ms. Eakins cannot lay a business records foundation for the prior assignees, the prior owners of the debt, for their records. They can get in their own records, but they can't get in their credit card statements from Washington Mutual, in this case from 4 years ago.
So how would those be gotten in? Do you have to have five records custodians, or you can use the affidavits?
You need either one.
Either one.
A record. I mean, the records affidavit has been going on for years. In this case, even, they put the bank records in by records affidavit. So
And they keep those affidavits in the regular course of their business in their records.
Sure.
But here,
yeah.
One was missing.
Well,
or there wasn't one.
There were no records affidavits, and there were no records custodians.
They did present a witness, and I noticed the Court of Appeals said she testified she was familiar with the procedures at the prior banks, but her testimony was that she was at many banks. Does your argument depend on that discrepancy, or are you saying also that familiarity with the general procedures at the banks is inadequate?
No, I think our statute requires that they need a records custodian or a records affidavit from the company that created the records.
Okay.
That's our position. The Court of Appeals held that since this lady had training at those specific institutions and was familiar with how those records were kept, she could lay that foundation.
Counsel, can I want to get straight to kind of a back end one of the arguments your opposing counsel makes. In the brief, they talk about your client admitting that he had a credit card from the company, that he had a debt from the company, and making some payments. Were those payments made to the current plaintiff?
The records indicate that they were, but it's not clear that my client knew that at the time. Mr. Askew testified that he admitted that he had at one time had a Providian credit card. He denied the amount of money that they were claiming was due, and he denied that CACH owned the account and had a right to collect it.
Well, I was going to say, if he admits that he had an account there and a credit card and he made payments to them, even though he might not have recalled that, would that cure some of the problems? It wouldn't, maybe as to amount, but as to the fact that this is the proper plaintiff.
Because
he paid them.
Oh, I don't think so, Your Honor. And we go into that in our brief. Mr. Askew testified that his wife was terrorized over the phone by some debt collector lawyer in Texas named Bamford, and they agreed to make two payments on the account. And then after they made the first account, they thought, who is this lawyer in Texas, and why are we paying him, and how much are we paying him? They then stopped the payment on the second check and then asked him to verify the debt. And they got nothing. And then six
and,
or eight.
And that testimony is in the record as well.
Yes, sir.
Okay.
Yes, sir. Yes, sir. It is. I see I'm over on my time. If there aren't any other questions,
you'll have some more time later for rebuttal.
Thank you, Judge.
And you two can manage that time accordingly.
Yes, sir.
Go ahead. Now, who took over? Didn't someone take over WaMu?
Washington Mutual. Yes, Chase took over.
Okay.
The assets of Washington Mutual, but at the time Chase purchased WaMu, the records had already been sold to CACH, and CACH had purchased the account. I'm going to start with the business records issue. there's nothing within the plain language of Section 490.680, which requires the sponsoring witness of business records to be an employee of the entity that created those records.
They have to know the procedures. They have to know that the entries are made contemporaneous with the transactions. They have to know that stuff.
That's true, and Diana Eakins testified here as to each of those requirements.
Yeah, but she didn't testify in fact that she knew about these companies, did she? Didn't she just say, I have general knowledge of the industry?
No, she testified that she had trained with most of the major banks, CACH.
Well, I understand that, but did she have knowledge of all the entities for which you needed documents in the record, specific knowledge of that entity and the way that they kept these records?
Yes, she testified that she had training with most of the banks that CACH deals with.
But that's all she said. She didn't say anything about understanding how they prepared things, how they determined identity, how they passed. I mean, she said, I trained with a number of the banks that this client works with. She didn't even testify to this specific one, and she gave no details of what that training involved. Why is this one phrase sufficient to suddenly validate the whole chain?
Well, under the case Uinchuk versus Mitchell, a court must view the evidence and the reasonable inferences therefrom in light most favorable to the trial court's judgment. And here,
why is that a reasonable inference from I trained a lot of places. It doesn't mean I know how they keep their records and what they do.
But she testified as to each of the requirements of the Missouri Business Record Statute.
Yeah, but she didn't do it as to each of the entities specifically.
She testified as to how each of the specific records from those entities were kept, that they were kept in the ordinary and normal course of business.
In her business. But the prior one, she couldn't know that. How could she know?
Because she testified that she had training with most of those things.
Yeah, but when you say most of them, that's a weasel word. Did she have training at every one of them?
And what
testified
that
every
involve?
One of them she knew as the identity and mode of preparation, and if it was made in the regular course of business. How can you testify to those things if you're not there?
Well, there was no cross-examination by Mr. Askey's attorney as to what that training entailed.
It doesn't have to be cross-examination. This is your burden to put this evidence on.
But she did testify that she had kept, that those records were kept in the ordinary and normal course of business, and that they were created at or near the time of the event. She wouldn't have known that if she hadn't had training with those banks.
Now, how do you differ this from the Lodge case where the witness there said that they were familiar with how things were done in the industry?
Well, in Asset Acceptance versus Lodge, the witness had just general knowledge of how banks kept records in the industry. Here, Eakins testified specifically that she had training with most of the banks that CACH deals with, and then she specifically said as to each of these records that they were created in the ordinary and normal course of business at or near the time of the event.
So does your argument depend on our agreeing with you that this case is unlike Lodge and that her statement about training is adequate to show that she had a basis for knowledge about how each document was prepared?
Well, that's one of our arguments. Another is that Askew admitted to the debt here. He made payments on the debt.
Well, he admitted to having a credit card and making payments. It doesn't mean he admits the amount, and that's the key issue, is figuring out, verifying the amount and is correct that you're suing for. That's what the plaintiff does. Plaintiff tries to prove how much money they're owed, and then the defendant would say yay or nay.
He did agree to pay the full amount of the debt.
Well, and that establishment of that full amount is your burden.
Yes, and I believe we satisfied that burden. Diana Eakins testified that Askew had given authority for his wife to speak with CACH and CACH's attorney. He agreed to pay for the full amount of
full
the
amount,
debt.
Whatever that full amount is, you have to prove what that full amount is.
Yes, and there was testimony as to what that full amount was.
But we're going back to the earlier question, which is his payment. I mean, it's your argument not just about the amount, but that you can, even if there's a flaw in the chain of showing the how the account got to your client, he admitted it got there and it was his debt, and therefore it doesn't matter that he failed to meet the business records exception. But what about opposing counsel's argument that that's really not the case? Someone called and said they owed the debt, they started paying, but then they realized we have no idea who this is, and you were unable to come up with proof and they quit paying. Why isn't that Why is that an admission, which is in effect what you're saying, when they, in those circumstances?
Well, Askew, through his payments, is saying that he believes that CACH is the owner of the debt.
But he's not. I mean, I understand, but he's explaining the circumstances that he assumed if someone called and said, you owe me money, that that must be the right person, but they then stopped payment because there was no proof.
What about, you want the inference that since he paid, he admitted he owed it. What about the inference of now I'm not paying and I want verification?
Exactly.
What about that inference? Is that a fair inference for us to take that maybe he questioned that previous judgment and so the?
Well, he asked for clarification at a later date after he had already made
well,
the payment
for,
arrangement.
Well, I understand he's under he asked for verification of the debt and never received it. And after that point, he never made any payments. Am I wrong on that?
No, he did receive verification of
what,
the debt.
What did he receive?
I believe he received copies of the account statements, the bills of sale, the Exhibit 9.
Mm-hmm. And then he never made any payments after that?
Right? No. But
are you saying it's binding because he made the first payment? I just wonder if there's law in this area. I can understand both sides of that argument. But you're saying he couldn't back out after making one payment without knowledge? Or is there law addressing this issue?
There is law that says that a partial payment implies a promise to pay the amount in full. Those are the Ozark Mountain versus Redis and Cheesler versus Staff.
So does that mean if a stranger to the transaction came and you know just wrote letters to people saying you owe me money and they paid them, they would suddenly owe the full amount of their debts to someone else?
It's an implied promise to pay, and obviously Askew could have put on evidence to the contrary that CACH doesn't own this debt, but there was nothing from the contrary presented by Mr. Askew.
What about the fact that after he sought verification, he didn't make any further payments?
Well, again, he had already made the payment.
Well, I understand.
Arrangement.
Right. So maybe there was an inference up to that point, and then he sought verification, and then he didn't make any more.
Well, again, I believe that we proved by preponderance of the evidence that CACH owns the account. Mr. Askew had made payments, which implies a promise to pay. He could have then presented evidence to show that CACH is not the owner of the account, but he failed to do so.
Do you agree that your witness or someone needed to have personal familiarity with how the predecessor institutions maintained these records in the ordinary course of their business?
Well, I agree that to get in certain records, you have to satisfy the requirements of Section 496.80, which I believe we did here.
And what is required to do that?
That there's testimony as to the identity of the documents, the mode of preparation.
But who can give that testimony? How do you? I mean, can anybody just come in off the street and do that, or what qualifications does the witness have to have who can do that?
The statute says it has to be a custodian or other qualified witness. Here, Diana Eakins testified that CACH purchased the account. The records were transmitted to Eakins in the ordinary and normal course of business. Washington Mutual is no longer even in existence. They're no longer custodians of the records.
But Chase is.
No, Chase purchased the assets of Washington Mutual, not debts and records that had already been sold to
CACH. But opposing counsel points out that in some other circumstance, if you know, somebody died who had a deed and you didn't get a copy of it, that's your problem. And failing to prove your case, why would we make an exception in the debt industry?
We're not asking for an exception. We're asking to be treated the same as all other cases. And then
well,
if you satisfy...
Let me ask you a question about that. Oftentimes, what about the cases that talk about, yeah, the records are admissible, but the hearsay within the hearsay
right.
isn't considered competent evidence? What about those cases if you wanted to be treated like the rest of the industries? How do those affect your case?
Well, again, Diana Eakins has had training with most of the major banks that CACH deals with, and she testified as to each of the requirements.
Right, right. And lots of times the doctors will say, well, I know the way other doctors keep records, and they hearsay within hearsay, and we say, well, that's not sufficient. That's not good enough. The business records affidavit gets you past the first layer of hearsay, but it doesn't get you past the second and the third layer of hearsay. So how does that affect your analysis?
I don't believe that it does affect it because Diana Eakins is in the same position as a new employee of Providian or Washington Mutual if they were in existence would be. There are many cases, Colette, Rosamano, Rouse and Nash that hold that there's no requirement that a sponsoring witness take part in the creation of the documents. If they have knowledge as to how the documents were prepared, as to how the information was recorded within the document.
So that's because I'm beyond this case. When we decide a case, we try to set a clear statement of guidance for future cases, mm-hmm. and that's the test you would provide, that you have a witness who has knowledge of the method of preparation of those, not just her current client, but prior holders of the instrument?
Yes, Judge.
Okay.
And here I believe we satisfy that requirement. You see the same sort of thing in medical cases when records are received from an ambulance or other hospitals and are transferred in the ordinary course of business to another hospital. All those records are signed off on by a business records affidavit. The whole thing gets into evidence because they're transferred in the ordinary and normal course of business.
Well, the records come into evidence, but the hearsay within the hearsay is not considered competent testimony when we deal with the sufficiency of whether or not a case has been made.
Well, here, as to each of the items within those records, there was testimony both by Diana Eakins, who testified she had personal knowledge, as well as admissions by Mr. Askew. And again, the most important thing to look at is the trustworthiness of the documents. That's what the case CNW Asset versus Samaji and many other cases here in Missouri hold. And here, Askew admitted that he had a Providian credit card. He admitted that it was his social security number on the application. He admitted that it was his signature. He admitted that the address on these records was correct. He admitted to the balance within the records through the payments that were made. He admitted to each of the items within those records.
So was the balance due agreed to by both parties?
Yes, there was a payment arrangement that was made. There were two checks that were issued, although one of those checks were later stopped.
But is the current balance agreed to by the parties?
Yes, it was agreed to through his payments. There was an implied.
No, when you say that, agreed to through his payments, you're inferring that from the payments. He didn't say, did he ever say, I agree it's this much?
Well, in the payment arrangement that was made with CACH's attorney.
By his wife?
By his wife, who he had given authority.
But he disputes that he gave her authority to agree to a specific amount, isn't that correct?
Yes, but his wife is cloaked with that authority because he gave her permission to speak with CACH.
Is there a difference between speaking with and binding?
Well, the facts, there's an implied apparent authority given to his wife through telling CACH that they had permission to speak with the wife through the payments made through their joint checking account and through the fact that both Mr. Askew and his wife's names were on the letters that were sent
CACH's attorney. We are compelled to look at the evidence in the light most favorable to the judgment. And so you were indicating that there is evidence in the record that would indicate he gave authority to her that the trial court could have believed that we are compelled to find in that light.
Exactly. And that's what the Court of Appeals found in the Rose Hill case cited in our brief holds that there's apparent authority given to a spouse. Then that spouse is acting on the behalf of their spouse.
Does the same concept govern the issue of whether his partial payment is an admission of that he owes the debt by making the partial payment? If, in fact, it's an inference that can be made either way, are we compelled under the standard of review to find the trial court believe that inference in favor of your client?
Yes, Judge. And there are actually a couple points in the transcript where Mr. Askew said that he was the one that made the payments rather than his wife. There was conflicting testimony on that. But regardless, it was out of their joint checking account, and Mrs. Askew had that apparent authority. In regard to standing, there was some mention of this Exhibit 9. That was an attachment to both bills of sale. That's referred to as an attachment to both bills of sale in Exhibit E. Diana Eakins testified that it's referred to in both bills of sale. It's an attachment to both the purchase agreement.
And what's at the top? Who created that document? Who the same exact accounts were transmitted from all these entities, and it was created prior to the first transfer?
It was created by Washington Mutual Providian, and it was transferred electronically, and when Diana Eakins received it, a CACH account number was assigned to each one of the accounts. You'll see that on the left side. But it was a document that was transferred along with the sale of the debt, and that's what links the bill of sale to Mr. Askew.
And opposing counsel saying it doesn't show it showed the debt in the first transfer, but you're saying it does, and we should just look at it, and we'll make a decision, or how do we resolve this?
Yeah, it's an exhibit to both bills of sale and both transfers. And Diana Eakins testified to that, and that's also in CACH's responses to discovery, which were in the
exhibit
E.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Now, why don't you get to this point? Why don't you deal with the issue about the apparent authority? Get to the lectern. That's good. And then deal with the issue of authority. And is that a legal issue or is that a factual issue? Whether or not does that be written as authority? Deal with the issue of authority and
the authority from the wife.
Affirmation of the debt.
Very well, Your Honor. I do have 3 points I want to hit real quick, and that's the first. The issue of whether or not Mrs. Askew was authorized to settle this account on behalf of Mr. Askew, no authority was ever given. There's no evidence of any authority ever given. If you look at the trial transcript, you'll see that all that was said was that Ms. Eakins says that their notes indicate that they had permission to talk to Mrs. Askew. That's all it said. Additionally, it doesn't matter if she had authority or not, because if we look at the call note transcript from Mr. Bramford's office in Texas of the conversation between Bramford's office and Mrs. Askew when they're talking about agreeing for her to make payments and things on the phone, there's never any mention in that entire transcript of conversation concerning an account balance. No balance was ever agreed to, therefore no account stated cause of action can maintain on this. Additionally, the only other evidence there would possibly be in this account of an account balance would be Exhibit 2, which would be the monthly statements. Those were inadmissible because there was absolutely no foundation given for that document by anyone ever in the entire trial transcript.
In fact, don't they differ with the plaintiff's exhibit number 11 as far as interest rate?
Yes, sir, they do.
So how would your client fight that?
That benefits my client, Your Honor, because the fact is there was no agreement here made. That's our position, is that there is no agreement. There's no definite balance agreed to on this, and any argument to the contrary is just not supported by the record.
Is it my understanding that when the transfer of the account's made, there's only the bottom dollar that's transferred?
That's correct.
Not how they got to it, how the money was spent, the interest rates?
That's correct.
Cash advance interest versus regular interest, penalty interest?
Correct, Your Honor.
Right?
It's just a name, an account number, and a balance most of the time. With regard to whether or not this payment made admits that CACH owns the account, it can't, because that would be amounting to a waiver of the issue of standing, and we can't waive standing. Standing can't be waived. With regard to the issue of whether or not Mrs. Eakins' testimony is better or worse than a new employee testifying about the documents that actually, you know, were created by that company. The new employee's testimony is valid. It's better because companies cannot speak for themselves. They have to have employees do it for them. Companies are legal entities, but they can't talk. So that new employee standing there in court testifying or writing the business records affidavit, vouching for these documents of their own company, that's first-party testimony. That's a first-party narrative of it. So it's inherently more reliable than a third party. We don't allow hearsay within business documents. Why would we make an exception and allow hearsay to lay the foundation for business documents? So I would urge the court to read carefully on all of these points. To my mind, they're asking us to make an exception for them to warranty something that was that had a warranty that was specifically disavowed when they bought it.
I guarantee you, we will read carefully.
Thank you very much, Your Honor. Were there any questions? Thank you very much.